Our gut microbes can create neurotransmitters, brain chemicals. So they can produce precursors to serotonin, which women love serotonin because we tend to run a little lower than men. And so when you have serotonin production, it makes us feel calm and good. Dopamine is another one. And so microbes can make these neurotransmitters.
Welcome to the Good Clean Nutrition Podcast. I'm your host, Ginger Holton. I'm an integrative registered dietitian nutritionist. Today on the show, I'm talking with gut health nutrition expert and host of the Gut Health Podcast, a registered dietitian with a master's degree in public health, Kate Scarlotta. We are talking about gut health today and its profound impact on your overall well-being. We're going to delve into the intricate world of microbiome dynamics, the effects of alcohol on your gut flora, and we're going to do some myth busting about some things you've likely heard about, probiotics, fermented foods, and a whole lot more. I've been having some fun lately helping my clients with GI issues. And as a dietitian, that actually is fun. And what we've been doing is playing around with a combination of dietary changes, but also targeted fiber and probiotics. So I had a client the other day who developed really severe, what I would call life-crippling diarrhea. Like she couldn't leave the house, and that developed from a medication change. She texted me frantically and was like, this side effect happened. I don't know what to do. I can't leave my house. It was really, really debilitating. So much so that she was actually trying to talk to her doctor about stopping the medication that she really needed for her health. That's really what people are up against. This can be so life-altering. And so I said, okay, let's talk to your doctor first and let's just see if they're okay with us trying some things from a dietary perspective. Of course they were. So I used some evidence-based recommendations for specific probiotics. And then I also used acacia fiber. That's one that I did specifically for diarrhea. And after about 2 weeks, she saw a reduction in her symptoms to the point where they were completely managed. And she was so thrilled that we could have such great results from making these targeted changes. So it really does require a deep level of personalization. But I just wanted to highlight that there is so much hope out there and so many options. And when you really get to learn about the gut connection to health, to nutrition, to diet, and all the different options about what you can do, you can take even a really serious problem and improve it quite a lot to the point where you get your life back. Hey, Kate, I'm so glad you're here.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me on.
I just wanted to start by getting a lay of the land because I feel like we throw around these terms like gut health and microbiome and even IBS. Like, what is gut health? How do you define that?
I feel like it's such a misconstrued concept, but in general, I think we can drill it down to a gut that allows for adequate digestion and assimilation of nutrients, that the gut microbiota is balanced so that we have a mix of what we call potentially pathogenic microbes with more health-promoting microbes, and they kind of balance each other out. I kind of think of like that healthy gut microbe or gut health is related to microbes that can all play in the same sandbox together. One's not bullying another. Also, just effective, strong immune system, because the majority of our immune system is actually housed in our gut. All of this together leads to energy and a good outlook on well-being. Even mood regulation is associated with gut health. So just kind of drilling it down, you know, it's working the way it should.
I think that's the most simple way of saying it. Like your digestion is working properly. And honestly, a lot of people's absolutely is not. When I think of gut health and I'm talking to folks about the gut, I often will say things like the small and large intestine. Do you see it that way? Or do you include the stomach? Or how do you define it?
I think it involves the whole GI tract. We're mostly focusing on the colon and the small intestine. The small intestine is where all the absorption occurs when we're breaking down food into digestible components to fuel the body. And then the colon is the richest ecosystem on earth. It's filled with trillions of different microbes. And we're really learning how important those microbes are to overall well-being, chronic disease risk, mood, so many other factors. So we used to kind of ignore them. We knew they were in there. And now we know they're really important for our overall well-being.
I worked at a really cool startup a few years ago, and we were doing some early gut microbiome testing, testing the genetics there and looking at diversity. I would say it was pretty early days, but one of our researchers there likened the gut microbiome to studying space. When you say the word trillion, it really helps identify that this is massive and there's so much to learn.
Absolutely. And I think of space as sort of that uncharted, unexplored area. And I've been following this gut health space for a really long time. I'd say early 2000, I really got into it. And as much as we know, and we know a lot in the last 25 years almost, we really don't know a lot. So we know a lot more about the bacteria that reside in the gut, but there's fungi and yeast and archaea, another type of organism that also are playing a huge role. And most of the gut microbiome studies have been done looking at stool. And there's a lot of microbes that live in the lining of the gut. The gut microbiome of the small intestine is vastly different than the gut microbiome of the colon. So, yeah, we know a lot about this, but it's really in its infancy, this science.
I've been practicing for about a decade, and I always think back when I was in school doing my master's 12 years ago, we didn't talk much about the gut microbiome. For me, it only really started to come into my world maybe within the past like 5 to 8 years.
Yeah, I would say mainstream sort of catching on to this has been probably like in the last 10 to 5 years, where you're hearing a lot more about it. Now it's blown up. But like anything that's popular in the mainstream press, it's just little pictures of the science. And, you know, science is complicated. Some people want to drill it down to a simplistic, just take a stool test and we can determine what's going on in there. And unfortunately, we're not there yet.
I get so many questions about personalized gut testing. And that is fascinating that you talk about the gut microbes that kind of stay in the gut versus the ones that are leaving via the stool test.
Well, they're more in the lining. So, you know, kind of like we have biofilms, right? And we can build up plaque, for instance, in our teeth. The microbes can kind of get inside sort of more the inner lining of the intestine. And so they're not just lost in the stool. And that's why, you know, it's just a little snapshot when we do a stool test. We also are learning in the beginning of the gut microbiome science, it was all about who's there. Are they the good guys, the bad guys? And now we really are noticing and following, it's more important what they're doing and not necessarily as important as who's there. So we're looking at those markers through what's called the metabolome and looking at particular types of metabolites that the microbes produce depending on their capacity to break down certain food components or cross-feed with other microbes that might be there. So some microbes will start the digestive process of fibers that resist digestion in the small intestine. They're starting to break them down, and then another group swoops in and finishes up what they're doing. Or some microbes really love hydrogen to make methane. So the microbes that make hydrogen gas, the methane methanogens, they're called, swoop in, grab the hydrogen and make methane gas. So there's a lot of crosstalk, cross-feeding that occurs, and that's very individual. So I always tell people that like your fingerprint, you have your own fingerprint of gut microbes too. And so that's why one size fits all for diet therapy usually doesn't work very well.
Like, deeply fascinated by what you're talking about, the microbes that live in the intestine. In order to study that, do we basically need to be taking live tissue? How are they figuring that out?
Well, they'll take cultures. They sometimes will do things by biopsy to see. We don't want them infiltrating the gut layer, right? I always say, like, kind of what should stay in Vegas should stay in Vegas. You know, don't take out all the secrets. So it's kind of the same thing. You don't want the microbes going through the gut, which is like when there's enhanced intestinal permeability. But there are some microbes that are right in that lining in their gut. And most of the culturing, they're looking at the fluids that are right there near the lining. They're not necessarily like cutting a chunk out.
When we talk about microbes, and you said something about yeast and fungi, there's in some ways negative connotation. Microbes are bad and fungi is bad and we don't want to have yeast overgrowth. You hear like antibiotics or probiotics. What are these microbes? How do we understand them?
It's a fairly new science, but I will speak to the sort of anti-fungi situation because there's a lot of alternative practitioners talking about candida overgrowth, which is a type of yeast. It's a very common yeast in the intestine. I will say that we don't have fungi. A lot of fungi aren't even classified yet. It's probably like bacteria. We've got a grip on that and we have less a grip on fungi. Most of us have some of these potentially pathogenic microbes in our gut. It's when they get imbalanced. And we are learning that there is a potential for imbalance of fungi. And some people do have candida infections. I don't believe to the degree that they're marketed to people, but some people that are on steroids will have thrush in their mouth or just an overgrowth of yeast in the small intestine. There's a physician down in Georgia, Satish Rao, he's world renowned, and he's starting to culture small bowel fungus and treating people. We don't know exactly how much fungi should live in the gut, so those numbers of what is sort of pathogenic isn't really well defined. But what he's finding in his practice is when they treat with an antifungal, those patients' GI symptoms improve. So there is signaling that there's something out there with fungal overgrowth too, but I'm not convinced that it's to the degree that's sort of, again, put out by a number of alternative practitioners in putting people on these very highly restrictive diets and a lot of herbal therapies. I mean, I've seen that really go down the wrong path for some people. There's a lot of herbals out there that have some good efficacy in treating some of these microbes. And for some reason, they're looked at as like not like an antibiotic, but they do have antimicrobial effects. So it's not like just because they're natural doesn't mean that they do no harm to the microbiome either. So I think just understanding, you know, natural compounds can also have negative effects on the overall gut microbiome as well.
That's an incredible point because a lot of people, they want to take something natural rather than pharmaceuticals, but they don't realize sometimes how powerful natural supplements or vitamins, minerals can be.
Absolutely. And they're not regulated. So we also don't know exactly what we're getting. So, you know, this concerns both ways, right? We don't want to over-medicate anyone unnecessarily. But don't just make an assumption that because something's natural and in supplement form, that there's no risk. I mean, we definitely see some supplements been associated with the liver failure. So they're not just all safe. We just have to be careful.
I want to talk about the gut connection to other parts of the body. And I'd love to hear more about the gut-brain connection.
So the gut and brain have this bidirectional conversation. And that's through the enteric nervous system of the gut. So that's the nervous system there and the central nervous system in the brain. And it's sort of connected by the vagus nerve. I always liken it to if you feel butterflies in your stomach, right? So you're nervous, your brain signals that you're nervous and you feel something in your gut. Or you're fearful before you go on a podcast and you're flying to the bathroom because your motility is affected, because that's brain-gut discussions back and forth. But it's also very interesting that our gut microbes can create neurotransmitters, brain chemicals, so they can produce precursors to serotonin, which women love serotonin because we tend to run a little lower than men. And so when you have serotonin production, it makes us feel calm and good. Dopamine is another one. And so microbes can make these neurotransmitters. And so alterations in your gut microbiota can change your mood and impact your mood through the regulation of the creation of these different brain chemicals that regulate the mood. And these travel through the brain gut through the vagus nerve. We also can stimulate the vagus nerve through diaphragmatic breathing and humming, and that can also kind of engage the parasympathetic nervous system, which is our rest and digest mode. So we often recommend the deep breathing, diaphragmatic breathing after eating. So it really engages through that connection your body to say, time to chill out and let's put all our energy into digesting. So very, very important. We see the gut-brain connection very highly interactive in conditions such as irritable bowel syndrome. But it is very interesting. The gut microbiome plays a role, the brain plays a role, the gut plays a role, and they all interact together.
One takeaway that I'm hearing is just being more mentally engaged with the eating and digesting process.
Totally.
And just coming more into the process instead of being distracted or fighting against it or thinking about it as something we just have to do.
So I think about just the notion of grabbing fast food in your car and you're in traffic and you're white knuckling it and you're multitasking. You're sitting at your desk and you're working on a paper and you're eating a row of Ritz crackers, you know? So we do need to kind of be mindful, look at the food, taste the food, prepare your body to be in that rest and digest mode rather than engaging your sympathetic nervous system where you're white knuckling it down the highway eating a burger. So many people do that, and it's probably part of the reason why we're having a lot more gut health problems.
You were talking the other day on your Instagram about another connection that I was intrigued by, the gut connection to skin.
So there are a number of skin conditions, acne, especially really pronounced large pimples, psoriasis, eczema, even rosacea, associated with alterations in the gut microbiome. And interestingly, in rosacea, when they've found a connection with small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which is an overgrowth of microbes in an area of your intestine that shouldn't be. And so when they treat the people with rosacea with a non-absorbable antibiotic, which is the typical treatment for SIBO or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, the rosacea clears. So we do see some alterations in this, what we call gut-skin bidirectional access. So there's different metabolites, different things that affect this connection. You know, we used to use antibiotics for kids, and it would clear their skin. Well, that's just showing you, again, this microbial skin connection. Not that that was the best treatment, maybe, but it was clearing skin. So you can kind of see that in that example.
I always think of you as really cutting edge and really pushing the boundaries on gut health and the connection between the body. Can you tell me more about gut health as relates to hormones or reproductive health?
Yeah, so this is a very complicated area, but we do see individuals that have low testosterone or low estradiol, which is the primary estrogen, as having low microbial diversity. So there seems to be some kind of connection with the type and variety of microbes and the amounts of these various hormones. We know that estrogen are a substrate for bacteria and contribute to the microbial diversity that way. We also know that eating foods with phytoestrogens, the microbes actually help convert them to the absorbable types of phytoestrogens for our body. But we're still really detailing this connection. I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. People are jumping the gun, making it seem like we can control your hormones with the following blood tests and supplements. And I'm not sure really that's mainstream understanding or evidence-based at this time. I anticipate we're going to see a lot more to this. But there is definitely association with these lower level hormone levels with a lower level of microbial diversity. And opposite to that, better testosterone and better estradiol is associated with microbial diversity. When I say microbial diversity, this is just a variety of different types of microbes, and that is associated with a better gut health. You know, have we drilled it down to the little details? No. But we know that when there's more microbes in the gut, of different types, that is a marker of gut health. It's a positive feature.
That is really, really exciting. And it made me think about menopause and perimenopause when women have a big dip in estrogen. Is that a time where we need to focus specifically on gut health? Do we know? Does gut health shift at that period of time?
Well, we know with aging that we do see a decline in diversity, you know, and that's been shown due to a number of things. The older you get, the sicker you tend to be. You're in the hospital more. You're exposed to antibiotics. You're on different medications. Your activity shifts. The environment that you're in, if you're in a hospital, you're getting different microbes. The environment will play a role here. So will there be at some point a woman going into perimenopause where they'll modulate the diet a little bit? I see that. There's a researcher in Ireland really looking at the diet of elderly individuals and seeing, you know, when their diet is good, their microbial diversity is better, but most people shift to more of a processed diet. So I think we will have tools to say, okay, you're in perimenopause, you should be eating X, Y, and Z to really maximize what's going on in your gut. We're just not there yet, unfortunately, because I think we could make a difference in people's overall health with aging.
And one thing you mentioned is phytoestrogen intake. And I am obsessed with talking about phytoestrogens because I work in oncology and there's so much misinformation about phytoestrogens, which are basically plant estrogens slash antioxidants that are commonly found in foods like soy or flax seeds, things like that. And what I'm hearing from you is that those could be beneficial to the gut microbiome.
That's correct. And there's even fruits that have phytoestrogens. It's just this varied diet, plant-based diet that continually is showing itself as being a positive modulator to the gut microbiome. So lots of plants, lots of plant variety. Those are key things.
I love talking about that as a dietitian because that's like a fun thing to do, right? Eat more colorful foods and different types of foods and make them in different ways.
I agree. And I think most people that go into dietetics love to eat and love food, like myself. And so, yeah, we want to have a variety and get people excited and joyful about trying different new things. And colorful foods are beautiful, and beautiful foods are fun to eat. So,
100%. Well, I want to hear a little bit more about what foods we should eat to maintain gut health. So, I'm hearing colorful, plant-based foods, and a variety of foods. What else should people be looking for when they're looking for a gut-healthy diet?
I think it has to be somewhat individualized, but we do know that adequate fiber is important too. So whole grains, seeds, and nuts, legumes are very good. Legumes are rich in galacto-oligosaccharides, and grains are rich in especially wheat, rye, and barley, and fructans. And these are two groups that are known prebiotics. So prebiotics are basically food for health-promoting gut microbes. So having a mix of those, as long as you can tolerate them, we're all different. And I work with a lot of people with food sensitivities and intolerances. Those are good adds. So adequate fiber, you know, around 25 grams for women, 35 more or less for adult men, and also plant diversity. So you're not just eating strawberries every single day. You might have strawberries a couple times, but then you add apples and pears and peaches and et cetera. In the American Gut Project, which is a citizen crowded project, it's based out of California, and they're collecting stool samples from around the globe. They also look at food tracking, what individuals are eating and lifestyle. And what they found in their sample is the individuals that were eating 30 different plants per week compared to those that had less than 10 per week had much greater microbial diversity. So the notion there is, yeah, you could eat a high-fiber, plant-rich diet, but you want to have more different types of foods daily so that you're adding to a variety of different plants. Don't just go to the grocery store and get your broccoli and oatmeal every single week. Break out of the habit and pick a couple, two, three different things. Or one of the ways I really like to add diversity to my plants is an oat bowl and I'm adding pumpkin seeds and flaxseed and blueberries and strawberries and kiwi fruit and maybe some almond butter, sprinkling some cinnamon, you could get 6 different plants just in your breakfast bowl. So kind of looking like, how can I make this salad a little bit more enticing by adding spinach and kale and different kinds of colored peppers? All of the things that dietitians love, but there appears to be some benefit to the gut bacteria and the gut microbiome. So that is one study. The other study that got a lot of traction was out of Stanford University, and they looked at fiber versus a very high fiber diet, 40 grams, versus a diet very rich in fermented foods, 6 servings a day, which is a lot of fermented foods. The fermented foods that they used in this study were all those that contained live and active culture. So sauerkraut is fermented, but if you pasteurize it, there's no live and active culture. But if you don't pasteurize it, there is. So that would be some of the differences. So in this study, mind you, there was 36 people, 18 that got the high fiber, 18 that got the fermented food. Very small studies don't have as much significance in evidence behind them. They can give us signals of what's working, but they're not like, oh, this was a study of 10,000 people and this is what we saw. That would be greater evidence. So this very small study that got a lot of traction learned that in the fermented food group, the 18 that got fermented food, 6 servings a day, they had greater microbial diversity. And this really was one of the first studies looking at fermented foods and the gut microbiome. Surprisingly, there's a lot of misinformation about fermented foods as a source of probiotics, which, myth busting, most fermented foods are not a source of probiotics. The types of microbes that are in fermented foods are uncharacterized. And in order for a live and active microbe to be classified as a probiotic, we need to know what it is and what it does. Doesn't mean fermented foods are bad. They're very good for us, but they're not a source of probiotics for the vast majority. So interestingly, in that study, the fermented food had greater microbial diversity than the high fiber diet. We also saw a reduction in inflammatory compounds such as interleukin-6, which is associated with type 2 diabetes and rheumatoid arthritis. So there seemed to be some additional benefits to consuming the fermented foods as well. Again, small study done in healthy people, not people with GI disease or otherwise. But there's signals, and it was an interesting, well-done study, but just in a small group.
It's no surprise that Orgain is America's number one plant-based protein powder brand because their products are really delicious and made with clean ingredients. I love their organic plant-based protein powder for my clients because it tastes amazing, and it's also packed with nutrients. It comes in a large variety of flavors and offers up to 21 grams of high-quality plant protein. It has a complete amino acid profile. There's no added sugar and no artificial sweeteners. Visit Orgain.com to learn more. Tell me about eating fermented foods for the natural probiotics versus taking probiotics.
Unless a fermented food, such as like Activia yogurt, it's a yogurt that has live and active cultures and it has a probiotic in it that they add, that it's a known probiotic that has been shown in the research setting to do something positive for the host. That would be a great example of a fermented food that has a probiotic. But for the vast majority of fermented foods, they do have live and active cultures. And that, in essence, based on the Stanford study, is helping increase microbial diversity. So, you know, just choosing things that have live and active cultures may be beneficial for your gut microbiota. Just know that most fermented foods are not truly a source of probiotics unless they're labeled with a specific probiotic that's been shown in the research setting to offer benefit.
I tell my clients to go to like the cold section of the grocery store and look for that. It'll say live and active cultures.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's what we're looking for, at least from the Stanford study, that live and active culture, those were the types of foods they used, kimchi, vegetables that were fermented, yogurt, that kind of thing. I think they used a cultured cottage cheese as well, but it should say live and active cultures.
I've been recommending cultured cottage cheese, and it's a very cool product that is readily available now.
Yes, I've been noticing that, and I haven't tried it yet, and I need to.
And tell me about taking probiotic supplements. What do we know about that?
So what I tell individuals that are interested in trying a probiotic, you want to really grasp what it is that you're trying to get from this probiotic. So if I had an individual coming to see me, had constipation, and they're curious what probiotic might benefit constipation, we would look up specific data on a specific strain at what dose to try for that benefit. If someone was generally healthy and wanted to take a probiotic, I'd probably say, probably wasting your money. I would encourage a variety of fermented foods and then feed those microbes that are in your gut with those wonderful plant-based, colorful diet components. That's going to be your better bet. Most probiotics go in, they're transient. They're just hanging around. They might affect what the other guys are doing in there a little bit, but they don't take habit in there. You know, like they're not residing per se. They're kind of visiting. So you stop taking them, they're gone. They're not seeding the gut in total. The other thing that's important to know that there are certain conditions, immunocompromised infants, that may be at greater risk for developing sepsis from taking a probiotic. So their very sensitive system allows the probiotic to get out of their gut and into their bloodstream and contribute to sepsis, which is life-threatening. This is a very minimal part of the population in general. Probiotics have been shown to be safe. But again, just reminding, there are risks to some of these things for certain people.
Some of my oncologists prefer that some people during chemotherapy that are immunocompromised, sometimes with ports, which is the entryway to get treatment that's often on your chest. A lot of oncologists don't want some of those clients taking probiotics. And I don't know how much research there is to support that.
Yeah, well, you can get line infections, right? So, and then you have the level of being immunocompromised due to chemotherapy. I personally wouldn't recommend a probiotic in that instance. And to be honest, I think the probiotic science is a little bit hyped more than it really, you know, we don't, the American College of Gastroenterology and the AGA, two big GI organizations really don't recommend probiotics, for instance, in irritable bowel syndrome. So just because the data is so mixed in, even in that space. So I'm not discounting them. I think we just need to learn more of what works for what person and do no harm.
Right. And what I'm hearing from you loud and clear is we have pretty good evidence that eating more diversity in foods, especially that 30, which Kate, I'm going to go home and count how many I eat in a week because I love that very tangible goal. And also eating fermented foods that have active and live cultures, that's where to go with this.
Absolutely. I don't think you can go wrong. And I don't think it strays from recommendations that dietitians have been making all along. We know through the Mediterranean diet, for instance, that a plant-forward diet is a good diet with excellent evidence to minimize chronic health disease risk. So when you're seeing the similar messages come across, then it just reminds us there is a growing data of just eating the rainbow, like you said, right?
Right. And this also made me think about your focus on whole grains, beans. We talked a lot about fruits and veggies. I'm still seeing a trend of low-carb diets and people doing paleo and especially keto, which are notoriously very low in plant diversity. Does that affect the microbiome?
So it's interesting. The keto diet, for instance, has some benefit in individuals with seizures, right? Epilepsy. And in that patient population, the microbiome changes tend to be more favorable on this very low carbohydrate diet. So it just tells you it's not one size fits all, right? But for the general person without epilepsy that just is on a super low carbohydrate diet, I would be concerned that they would be starving those microbes that play a role in keeping our immune system healthy, our skin healthy, lower risk of chronic diseases, keep moods stable. And is that even sustainable for someone we don't see people really sticking with some of those diets. They're all over the place. So I would be a little concerned for the general person just doing that, say, for weight management.
I wanted to hear a bit more about how substances like medications that people take and alcohol can affect the gut microbiome.
So let's start with alcohol because I love a glass of wine. So I would just say it really comes down to moderation in all things. When people are overindulging in alcohol, that's really detrimental to the gut microbiome. It decreases diversity, increases risk of that condition, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and really just negatively affects it. Having a glass of red wine with dinner, really, it's not the French paradox that like, oh, this is so good for us. I think we're really seeing that alcohol is a toxin. We have to be careful with it. But having one drink, cheers, you're probably fine. Not saying that it's beneficial to the gut microbiome, probably not. Although there are some oligosaccharides and polyphenols in certain, you know, like a glass of red wine, Guinness has some interesting components that can be beneficial to gut health. So there may be little things in there. It's the excess, which is the problem and what most people really kind of get into. So alcohol can be a double-edged sword. Enjoy it in moderation, but don't go crazy. Don't kid yourself that it's doing this wonderful thing for your health and well-being. And then when it comes to drugs that we take, a couple come to mind, antibiotics, right? So we can have full spectrum antibiotics when we don't really know exactly what we're treating that really can wipe out the colonic microbiome quite a bit. When you have a pretty stable microbiome, it bounces back. So that's the good news. But you don't want to push to take an antibiotic. We need antibiotics. Thank God we have antibiotics, but we don't want to take them and push for them because they do have this effect on the gut microbiome. And some microbes just don't return. And that's what we're seeing. Just over generations, we've lost some of those key microbes because of use of antibiotics. We also know that kids with antibiotic use have a higher risk of being overweight, higher risk of having IBS. Another medication that is really overprescribed is proton pump inhibitors like Nexium. These are important medications that can reduce risk of esophageal cancer in people that have a condition called Barrett's esophagitis. And they're often used for reflux and heartburn, which can be really debilitating for some people. Some people need to be on them, but they do change the acidity of the gut. So when you're reducing the acidity, you're making something more alkaline. And in a more alkaline environment, pathogenic microbes can grow. We also have associated with PPI use with an infection called Clostridium difficile or C. diff infection, where you have this copious amount of diarrhea. It can actually be life-threatening. Some people require something called a fecal microbial transplant to get their gut back in line with that. And PPI use is associated with that as well. We need medications. Grateful that we have them. But overuse can have some effects on the gut microbiome.
I'm so glad that you bring this up because I'm hearing some of my clients say, I don't want to take any antibiotics ever because it's bad for you. Or I had a client recently that just took herself completely off her PPI proton pump inhibitor for gastric reflux. And she suffered horribly, right? Because you're not supposed to just go off of it all of a sudden. And you need antibiotics sometimes. And we really need to be having more thoughtful conversations about when to use them and how and what that looks like.
Yes, don't overdo them, but there are going to be times when you absolutely do need them.
How do I know if I have a healthy gut? Like, what are the signs? What does that look like? And how do I know when something's wrong?
So usually it comes down to a few things. The primary thing is what's happening in the toilet bowl. So you should be having regular bowel movements, what we'd call normal. Normal is typically snake-like bowel movements. It can be anywhere from every day, it could be three times a day, it could be three times a week. Everyone's a little bit different. Don't panic if you don't poop every day. Poop that's normal typically is brown. I don't want to panic people because everyone has diarrhea occasionally. Everyone gets constipated occasionally. Our poop can look a little different color depending on what we ate, but we're looking at the general classification. So gut health, typically you're not getting bloated, looking 9 months pregnant every night. Everyone gets bloated, but there's a difference between really painful bloating where you have to change your clothes every evening to feeling a little fuller when you've had a high fiber meal. I would say balanced mood, good skin, good energy, strong immune system. Because again, remember, your gut houses that majority of your immune system. So if you're constantly getting respiratory infections, constantly getting sick, that could be a signal that your gut health is a little off too.
My clients always tell me when they're going to mention being bloated or having gas or diarrhea, constipation, they always say, sorry for TMI. And then I always say, I'm a dietitian. This is super important to what we're talking about.
Agreed. We have to destigmatize poop talk, right?
It's a really important part of digestion and your health and your body, and it tells you a lot about gut health. I want to talk about IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. How do we know if it's like, oh, I'm having normal bloating or, you know, I'm having the occasional GI issue, or we have something more serious going on?
So with irritable bowel syndrome, for instance, pain is key part to that diagnosis. So when you're experiencing pain, that's not normal. And that definitely should be escalated. I mean, there's a number of other red flags in the digestive health space. So like if you were having weight loss, if you have irritable bowel syndrome, that's the question, and you're having nighttime symptoms, that's usually unusual. Like waking up and having urgent diarrhea is not typical of irritable bowel syndrome, for instance. Unintentional weight loss, blood in your stool, family history of inflammatory bowel disease, and suddenly you see blood in the toilet. It could be a hemorrhoid. It could be that you're beginning to have inflammatory bowel disease too. So any really changes in your habits should be at least at a minimum discussed with the healthcare provider. I would say the condition, you know, a rare condition, but ovarian cancer can have a lot of bloating and abdominal pain associated with it. And we don't want to miss things like that that can be life-threatening. So don't self-diagnose. Make sure you talk about any changes in your bowel habits or patterns with your provider so that they can make the assessment whether it needs to be escalated and worked up or just watched.
You know, a takeaway from today is certainly to normalize talking about bowel habits and gut health and really speak up if you're noticing that you're suffering in any way or having pain or having changes, and just making that a normal part of your check-ins and your conversations with both dietitians and physicians.
Agreed.
In our next episode, we'll continue our gut health conversation with Kate, focusing on the most common GI issue affecting millions of Americans, IBS. Our show is sponsored by Orgain and produced in collaboration with Large Media. That's L-A-R-J Media. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Good Clean Nutrition Podcast. To stay up to date on the latest podcast episodes, be sure to subscribe. And if you want to submit a voice message with a question or comment about the show, please visit healthcare.orgain.com/podcast to record your message. And if you like this podcast, I'd love for you to let us know. You can rate and review this show on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, or you can give us a thumbs up on YouTube if you're watching right now. I'm your host, Ginger Holton. You can find me online at gingerholtonnutrition.com. Thanks so much for listening.